It's time now for All You Ever Wanted to Know, a chance for you to get to know what's going on in and around your community and the fabulous people that make it happen. With On the Land, here's Jack Dawes.
Well, once again, good morning. And this morning we are in post-blizzard Saskatoon. We're here for Crop Week. Wouldn't be Crop Week without some weather. In fact, the local news media this week were making a lot of the fact that 10 years ago yesterday, there was a major blizzard that shut everything down for a couple of days. Well, Saskatoon had the blow last night, and it was pretty nasty for a while, but then we passed it along. And now I understand that that blizzard ended up in southern Manitoba, where our good friend and colleague Harry Siemens is. And we have Scott Fitzsimmons with us, switching us all together, coordinating it from the station in Yorkton. So we're going to be, the reason we're in Saskatoon is Crop Week, and we're going to touch on, well, actually some fairly decent weather news with Drew Lerner, Fusarium. It was a nasty year for Fusarium, and one of the biggest farmer session turnouts was for the Fusarium session. Look at the way oats are shaping up. Mike Jubenville with a look at world markets, and particularly canola and soybeans. Water, several of the commodity groups that met here in Saskatoon this week passed a motion asking the provincial government to delay its planned water management bill. And we'll also hear from the minister on the Minister of Environment, Scott Moe, on he says he's going to consult some more. Those are just some of the stories that we're looking at here from Crop Week, which wraps up today. But maybe just before we get into a chat with Drew Lerner, so Harry Siemens, tell us from Winkler about that. You say it's one of the worst you've seen around there?
Well, you know, we've had record amounts of snow in December, and then we had two blows after the new year. So we've had there's snow banks that, you know, you didn't even know were banks, you know, like it's just real. And this morning, and it was like we got all that loose snow around. So this big, quick storm came through. And last night at 11 o'clock, I picked my wife up in Morton. It was blowing, but okay. This morning at 8, well, all the schools are closed. Everything's shut down. And between Winkler and Morton, which is 8 miles, 20 cars in the ditch. I've never seen anything like that before.
So you're telling me you've got some pretty bad drivers there in Manitoba?
That too. But, some of these guys, as if they'd gunned it and tried to get through to the other side, you know, like they were right in the middle.
Yeah, well.
And it wasn't slippery.
So now, Harry, you have a piece, I understand, for us on manure application. Is that what's coming up?
Doug Redica, Precision Pumping out of Steinbach, Manitoba, and Niverville, has been in the business longer than most, and I met up with him at actually at a dairy meeting in Winnipeg, and he talked about some of the things that have happened in manure. This year, of course, was very wet, which is a challenge to those guys, and some of the things looking forward.
All right. Well, we'll have Harry bring us that piece a little later on. Now, speaking of southern Manitoba, Drew Lerner of World Weather Inc., one of the lead speakers at Crop Week in Saskatoon this week, actually that was on Monday, was mentioning that he thinks southern Manitoba, with all the snow you guys got in the last couple of weeks, are probably going to be in for some spring flooding, which, of course, you are used to. But on this cold spell we've been having, I guess Drew thinks that there's some good news around the corner.
Yes, we've basically drained all the really cold air out of the Arctic. There's just a little bit of cold left, and we'll probably experience that in the next couple of days. And I think after that, we'll see a notable warm-up. It'll be significant only because of the fact there's no, the airflow hasn't changed, but the air up in the Arctic is not as cold as it has been. So it will definitely warm up.
So if I'm a farmer in Saskatchewan right now, I mean, I was looking at what you said about springtime. In what areas of the province do I look at the forecast and say, okay, things look good? And in what areas of Saskatchewan do I look at the forecast and say, gee, I might have something to worry about?
I think for the most part, most of Saskatchewan is probably looking at a fairly good situation because of the fact that most of the province doesn't have a surplus of moisture. Let me take that back. Surplus of snow on the ground. There's plenty of moisture in the ground. And that's why I think it's a good forecast, because there's not a lot of additional snow that's going to be coming up. So I say that knowing full well it will snow, but it's not going to snow substantially like it has in Manitoba. So Manitoba is a different story, and maybe the southeast corner of Saskatchewan, those areas probably are going to see a little bit problem with too much moisture in the spring. So the forecast isn't real great for them, but it is tending better.
And for summertime, you said we're looking at probably a slightly wetter than normal year, is that right?
Yes. I think the summer season will start off with scattered showers. We'll end up peaking early and having quite a bit of rain midsummer, and then we'll most likely end up with a trend towards drying in late summer. It'll be really good for finishing out the crops and leading us into harvest. I think it'll be a great finish to the year, but it'll be challenging at the beginning.
And can I ask you one more question? I mean, I understand what you're saying precipitation-wise. What about temperature-wise? Are we expecting summer to be warmer than normal or cooler than normal or about average?
The temperatures will probably be near to slightly warmer than normal, but more so warmth than below. It's not going to be colder than normal in very many places. But there will be a tendency when it's raining frequently for us to have a little bit more of a cooler bias around. Overall, it's going to be fairly average, I would certainly think, but maybe a slight bias towards the warmth.
What challenges are there right now for you putting together a long-range forecast? You say there's not really a clear picture that there might be in some other years.
Yeah, that's right. There's certain patterns that we look at, and most of those are very helpful when you try and make a long-range forecast. If there's a tendency for them to become a little ill-defined, then the forecast becomes a little weaker, and it introduces the opportunity for differing weather patterns to kick in and take precedence over some of these others. And what we're seeing right now, we've lost La Nina. The 18-year cycle is being very inconsistent right now, and there's a lot of other smaller cycles that are out there that are just kind of hanging around, but any one of them could become more significant as time goes on. So it creates a more of a challenge in the long-range forecast that's almost anything can go. So we got to be careful.
From your perspective, when do you think we'll have a better idea to let farmers have an indication on when what things might happen? Will it be March? You'll have a better picture?
Yeah, six weeks from now. It'll take about 6 weeks for the after effects of La Nina to work its way out of the atmosphere, and then we'll fall back into these other patterns. So I'm sure that by the time we get to the 1st of March, we'll know what's going on. It'll almost be too late, right?
Yeah.
But we'll have a much better idea. So,
based on your 18-year cycle, you looked at the last three. Which one do you think at this point we're most going to be similar to?
We'll be similar to 1981, but we will not be as warm as we were in 1981. And we'll be a little bit wetter than 1981. But that's the general trend. If you want to go back into your record books and look at those that year, that would be the one that I would look at for right now. And then we'll know more when March comes around.
For farmers with crops still on the field and want to harvest in April, at this point, what do conditions look like early in the season?
It's going to be a little bit of a challenge, I'm afraid, in some spots. I do not expect it to be exceptionally wet across Saskatchewan in the spring, but we have moisture left over, and it's not going to be ideal. But I do think that we'll be able to make progress, and the odds are pretty good that the situation will be better than what everyone's worried about. The northwest flow that's going to be prevailing in the spring will keep us a little bit drier flavored. Might keep us a little cool, too, for a little while, but we will get out of that, and we will start to warm up. And I think without the precipitation around, we'll warm up quickly, and I think it'll end up being good. But that extra work is going to have to be dealt with, and unfortunately, the sooner they get in the fields to get that done, the better it is. And, well, it's hard for us to get in the fields any earlier than we do already. So it will be a little bit of a challenge, I think.
So that, again, was Drew Lerner of World Weather, Inc., one of the keynote kickoff speakers to Crop Week in Saskatoon. He's seeing a more or less benign beginning to spring and summer, or so it seems, but we'll have to stay tuned, I guess, to find out more about that story. Well, one of the, I think, most anticipated sessions here at Crop Week this week, at least by many farmers, turned out to be on our old friend Fusarium. There was, of course, lots of it. It was everywhere last summer. Now, Randy Kuchar, who is a researcher, was speaking to oat growers. he felt that oats probably fared better than a lot of the cereal crops through the fusarium outbreak, partly because, if I understood him correctly, the oat panicle, the head being the way it is, the oats kind of are all separated from each other, whereas in something like wheat, of course, it's more tightly packed. That being said, this next audio we're going to bring you, you're going to hear a farmer, first of all, speaking with Randy Kuchar following his presentation, and then myself picking it up and talking to him about how oats, or at least how the fusarium story spun out in the past crop year.
There was no disease in your area. It was very important, but now not nearly so much.
Okay.
Right? But just for good crop establishment.
So as long as you get good germination and get out of,
yeah,
out of the ground.
I mean, normally I would say if there's races, then you don't want to bring new races into your field. But we don't really have races in fusarium because we don't have any very many resistance genes, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, and you won't find clean seed this year, it sounds like.
Okay.
And the guys upstairs, everything's got some fusarium.
Yep.
So you might look at treating if it's just too badly infected.
Okay.
So, Randy, I know you're a great draw, but obviously, judging by the crowd here today, yeah, everybody's got to use their...
It's a topical issue, right, that people
yeah.
want an answer, and unfortunately, I kind of delivered the bad news. There's no easy answer,
yeah.
right?
So just talk about that a bit. You're talking an integration of a whole bunch of strategies.
At least three. At least trying to grow a third, fourth, or fifth crop. You know, like, I've worked with Guy Lafond, who I'm sure you know. I've worked on that big project out at Scott with a six-year rotations, and they did 18 years. When I work on those, they're boring. There's no disease, right? There's very little. You get a little sclerotinia 1 year. You probably would get a bit of fusarium, but six-year rotations, there's not nearly the problems with disease in insects. But how do you make money with 6 years? I don't, you know, if we got six crops, we can grow.
In your discussion about timing, you were talking about a number that I didn't really understand.
You mean the rate, the scale?
Yeah.
Well, the numbers were just indicating the stage of the spike. So as it comes out of the boot, so it's clear and free and clear of the boot, that's 59.
Mm-hmm.
And then 61 is basically the first area, first time you probably should put the fungicide on, and by 65 you're getting to the end, and 69 you're too late. So that's basically the anthers have all turned white. You're probably, at current thinking is you're wasting your money. But that Japanese paper suggests, well, maybe you can bring the tox level down, the toxin level down. So that's what our project is a bit about. And I know we'll run into pre-harvest interval issues, but I've talked to PMRA, I've talked to some of the industry folks. The industry folks tell me they always ask for 30 or 36 days because they're pretty sure that it's going to be degraded by then, whatever product. But it may be worth investigating. Maybe it's degraded after 10 days, 14 days, you know. So it's a bit of a long shot, but I think it's worth pursuing.
Thanks.
Sure.
So that, again, is Randy Kuchar, researcher at the Crop Development Center at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. With the discussion, follow-up to his presentation about fusarium and some studies they are doing. Now, we are told that the PowerPoints from the Crop Week presentations this week will be up on a website. I'm not exactly sure when that will happen, but we'll pass that along to the folks when we know more about it. Well, this morning, as Crop Week, CropSphere wraps up, the AGRA arm, that's provincial research organizations, including the East Central Research Foundation at Yorkton, presentations this morning, one of them from Mike Hall. Mike serves as the research coordinator for the East Central Research Foundation and at Parkland Regional College in Yorkton. If you happen to be with us on the program last week, you might have heard us talking about lentils. These days, not a lot growing in eastern Saskatchewan, but Mike with some suggestions or some success there, I might say. Second part of his work last year was, as a matter of fact, on fusarium and spraying. Mike did some innovative testing of nozzles, and here's the first part of an interesting discussion about nozzle technology in fusarium.
I compared a conventional nozzle, which was a bubble jet nozzle, and I compared it to a dual nozzle. So the dual nozzle has a 10-degree forward-facing upward angled nozzle and a 50 degree backward angled nozzle to it. So you're trying to coat both sides of the wheat head, because if you get good coverage, it's going to improve your suppression of the disease. But these dual nozzles, they don't have a very high operating height. You know, it's only around 12 to 15 inches above, you know, the heads that they're supposed to be operated at. And producers like to operate at higher heights than this because they're trying to protect their booms, obviously. And so I looked at those two nozzles, and I looked at them at their optimum height. So for the dual nozzle, it was 15 inches, and for the bubble jet, it was 25 inches. And then I looked at those two nozzles again at excessive heights of, you know, 36 inches above the canopy. And then I also looked at different spray pressures of 40 PSI, 70 PSI. So the 40 PSI gave me a very coarse to a coarse spray and provided 10 gallons per acre, and then the 70 PSI made a less coarse spray and provided 13.2 gallons per acre.
So that again is Mike Hall, and Mike is well, he's probably done his presentation now, but is presenting this morning at Crop Week and some of the final sessions. Now his discussion about height was interesting, boom height that is, because certainly that's something that Randy Kuchar, whom we heard from earlier, was expressing the his thoughts that the boom height needs to be lower for more effect. But as Mike says, normally commercial farmers are traveling fairly fast and keep the boom fairly high. But again, Mike Hall says height is crucial.
When you took a conventional nozzle, it covered the front of the head well, but and provided okay coverage of the back of the head in our study. But then when you move the conventional nozzle too high, it still provided good coverage of the front of the head, but coverage of the back of the head was totally lost. And the way we assessed this was with water-sensitive paper at the time of spraying on wooden dowels in front of each plot. So then you take the dual nozzle, and it was sort of the opposite situation. Under the conditions of our trial, you know, we got really good coverage of the back of the head and okay coverage of the front of the head, but then when you moved it too high, coverage of the front of the head was totally lost. It was gone. And those differences actually resulted in differences in yield and differences in fusarium control that we detected later. So when we, for both nozzles, when they were operated too high, we had about 4 to 5 less bushels per acre. So something like a 65 bushel crop became a 61 bushel crop. And we had higher levels of fusarium damaged kernels in visually observed in the field and in the grain sample at the end. So moving those booms too high cost money. And I'm assuming most of the lost money was reduced fusarium control, and most of the yield probably was fusarium damage, kernels blowing out the back. I suppose it could also have been some poor leaf disease control, but I don't have any observations to either confirm or deny that.
Again, that's Mike Hall with the East Central Research Foundation, one of the speakers today here at Crop Week. Now, Mike, in our discussion, mentioned to me that the Bayer people have been doing some trials and working with farmers, trying to get them to slow down that sprayer somewhat. Mike was spraying at about 6 miles per hour, but he tells me the average commercial farmer probably sprays at 12 to 18 miles per hour. So there's, of course, some further discussion to go on that. Here's Mike's final comment about nozzles.
I'm hoping to replicate this trial, but I'm going to do it at 12 miles an hour. I know some of the Bayer guys have been experimenting with producers, and they've kind of come to the conclusion that they're trying to get producers to slow down to 12 miles an hour because they're seeing all kinds of coverage issues when they're way up at 18 and this sort of thing. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of factors that go into the kind of coverage you're getting on the wheat head. And I think it's worth it for every producer to invest in some water-sensitive paper, stick a wooden dowel out there and see what you're actually doing. You know, because the height of the boom is going to make an effect. Even the direction of the wind could make an effect on what kind of coverage you're getting. And the speed at which you're traveling through that field can make a difference. So I'm hoping to do this work again next year, but as I said, at 12 miles an hour, and I'm having to be creative with the design of my trials in order to get my tractor up to that, give myself a runway to get myself up to those speeds in order to spray at that speed. The other thing I want to do, too, is just for interest's sake, I'm going to have one treatment where I spray in one direction, and then I'm going to spray in the opposite direction, so I'm going to get perfect coverage of the back and the front of the head. And, you know, I just want to see what is the potential, you know. What is the potential when you get perfect coverage on the heads, you know. How much of a difference can it make?
Because
the fungicides we've got out there, you know, are only registered for suppression of Fusarium head blight, but I'm sure part of the problem is, you know, getting adequate coverage on both the front and back.
That again, Mike Hall with the East Central Research Foundation. Now, Mike has posted videos on the ECRF website that help explain some of his work further. That's www.ecrf.ca, and that and other of those videos are there. Mike Hall from the Parkland Regional College and East Central Research Foundation. Interesting stuff. Harry Siemens is with us on the line. Harry, we're going to get into that storyline you have later about manure management. But no doubt southern Manitoba last year was dealing with the massive fusarium outbreak as well.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't quite as bad as they initially had thought. There was some, but you know, we had weird weather. I mean, in some places, of course, it was a wipeout, and so they didn't even have crops in some areas. But then other areas, it just, you know, somehow it seemed to be just a bit better. So even winter wheat again, guys are growing winter wheat, and it comes in a bit earlier, so. It wasn't as bad as it was in Saskatchewan.
Okay. Well, of course, places like Rosetown with almost 38 inches of rain were unusually wet last year on the west side of the province. That's normally so dry. And by the way, Mike Hall, of course, talking about tests next year. What he's talking about is the next crop year, because we're into next year country already. It's On the Land from The Rock 98.5, and we're live from Crop Week in Saskatoon. Next up, we're going to hear from an oat trader and what the outlook for oats might be. Also in our second half, we'll hear from Mike Jubenville, his thoughts on what could be happening, especially in the oil seeds area, and Harry Seaman standing by with an interesting piece on manure management. Stay with us for that. We take a break, and we're back with more On the Rock from the Land.
You won the bunch for lunch.
Really? I never win anything.
Everyone can be a winner. Call in during our all-request lunch at noon from Monday to Friday and get entered to win a bouquet of flowers from Growers Direct, plus a certificate to West Broadway Grill. No open late. What are you waiting for? Call in today. Bunch for Lunch, only from The Rock 98.5.
I'm pregnant. I have never felt so lost. I can't be pregnant. I can't be pregnant. Somebody help me.
Hang in there. Birthright is on your side. Whether you need a free pregnancy test or just someone to listen, we're here for you 24/7 every day of the year. No judgment and completely confidential. We meet you where you're at, single or married, and all our services are free. Birthright, 1771 Rose Street, Regina. Call us toll-free at 1-800-550-4900 or visit birthright.org.
This message is brought to you by St. Mary's Ukrainian Catholic Church and Parkland Right to Life.
Don't wait!
15th, get your big four-wheel drive tractor ready for spring. Take advantage of Value Tire's special winter rate. Save on labor this January and February on your new tractor tires. Value Tire's got it. A huge selection of sizes and brands. The ever-popular Petless, Michelin, Galaxy, and Dynamo tractor tires. Avoid disappointment. Book early. Petless tires are like hotcakes. They're going fast. Value Tire, Highway 10 East Yorkton. Yorkton's largest selection of tires.
I'm worried about my kids. What would happen if I die?
Hi, I'm Rob McDill with LR Future Insurance and Investments. Without careful planning, the administration of your estate may encounter long, painful, and avoidable delays. More significantly, someone other than yourself may end up deciding the transfer of your estate. I'll help you plan for your unique situation. Call us at LR Future Insurance and Investments today at 783-7737. Let us help you discover your future.
You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you have a question for today's guest, call 783-5160 or 1-855-449-5160.
So, we're live from Crop Week in Saskatoon on the show today, All You Ever Wanted to Know. And as always, the various commodity groups have their annual general meetings and usually have a market analyst with the Saskatchewan Oat Development Commission and Prairie Oat Growers. Kenrick Exner is a longtime oat trader with Viterra. He's in charge of barley, oats, and I think they're what they call byproducts at Viterra these days as far as trading. Kenrick, again, was the oat resource person. We had a chat following his presentation.
All I can say is from a grain company status, we have end users inquiring if we can supply a product that's glyphosate-free, and our feedback to them is that we have to involve the entire industry from the farm level to the line companies to the end users to find an amicable opportunity or educate ourselves about what the ramifications are if we do go down that path, and that's just been our biggest push, is to make sure we know that all parties involved understand what can or may not happen, and if it's actually a feasible way to grow oats. I think there'll be some impacts, and I just don't want to see us rush into something and then find out down the road that we lose acres because it's not viable for the farmer.
So what is there... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, what are the implications for growers?
Well, I think right now it's a time management tool. It's also a practice for weed control, which has a huge impact. And at the end of the day, if 50 to 70% of growers out there are using glyphosate, obviously it's something they value on their farm to help with harvest. So that's a pretty big number. It's a big percentage. And I think if you're asking them not to use that product, what are the alternative solutions and what is that impact to their farm?
It's a factor for the appearance of the oats, too, isn't it?
I don't know the scientific, and I won't comment on that, but there's talk that it could. But I'm not educated enough to speak to the scientific performance.
Maybe.
I think it's more so a time management for the producer, and again, it's a farm management practice that's been used for quite a long time, and something he values pretty heavily in his farm, and has used it on a pretty good percentage.
So, is there a movement within the industry? You said like more study is needed, or more scientific proof. Is anybody trying to pull that together?
That's a great question. I don't know. You'd have to ask. I think there's demand for that. Again, that's why we continue to caution that as an industry, we all need to get together to understand what those ramifications are and if it's feasible and how we go from here, because there will be a significant impact. Oats are a small commodity in the Western Canadian landscape, and I think there's long-term demand. And if you have something that's going to change the industry like that, we need to educate ourselves before we make rash decisions. And again, I've said it before, is make sure all parties are involved and have a say at the table.
With questions about just how much quality grain was produced this year, there's implications for the market as we get towards the end of the crop year. You had some numbers and some ideas about what we might see for old crop pricing in the second half of the crop year. Could you run over that?
Yeah, I think there's obviously a range of pricing out there. It's really going to determine on that last 25% of production, is it milling quality or not? And do we see demand being stable throughout the rest of the crop? crop year, it comes down to supply and demand. Is the product out there or isn't it? If we do have enough to get us through new crop, then I think prices will stay relatively stable to where they are, which is around $2.75 to $3. And if we do run out of milling quality, we may see a 25 to 50% premium over that of anywhere from $3 central sass to $3.25, $3.50. Again, it all depends on if supply can meet demand.
So I guess there was a question. Do you think the market's going to drive more or less acres this year?
I think the market's relatively flat. I don't see a lot of opportunity for increased demand. I think the market's going to bid what they need to get sufficient acres in the ground. So we may potentially at the race price signal see an increase of anywhere from 5 to 15% of owned acres in the ground for next year.
And that's at a price of where do you think, you have a price?
I think for an increase of 5 to 15%, we're going to have to see new crop prices $2.75 to $3 for central.
That again, Kenrick Exner, and I erred in not mentioning as we went into that discussion that he was originally discussing the glyphosate question. Of course, grain millers have put an embargo on any oats that they would buy if they've been sprayed with glyphosate. That was the first part of that discussion. By the way, Scott Shields from Grain Millers was at the show. I had a chance to chat with him. It pretty much confirms the price range that we discussed with Kenrick there, although I don't think he ever mentioned the number 350, but that's an interview we'll carry at another time. And we're live at Crop Week. Harry Siemens is with us on the line from Winkler. Now, Harry, your discussion coming up next with someone in the ag industry relating to manure management.
It's, more manure management and more manure application, the value that there is, when it used to be a waste and we called it SHIT, and he still does. He has T-shirts all over the world that say that, and at the same time, it's become really valuable, and he talks about some of the things they've done and some of the things that they'll be doing in the future. Doug Redekop of precision pumping out of Le Brocherie and Steinbeck and Niverville, Manitoba.
First thing that comes to mind is when you made reference to the fact that 2016 and 2004, both wet seasons, and maybe this year probably over a longer period of time, maybe even wetter. I don't know. But you're telling me that things have changed and made things a little bit better with... You go ahead and explain.
Well, I think the big thing, Harry, is our willingness and ability to adopt new technologies. That has been critical to our success. And also recognizing that we don't want to hire just anybody. We want to hire and foster only the best people.
I remember when manure was SHIT.
Yep.
It was a waste.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also seen how it's turned into a commodity. Is that explaining it properly?
It's very critical. I know that the agenda on part of the integrators is to gain value for the manure, and every year to try to do better than the year prior.
So is that happening?
It is happening. When I worked for Maple Leaf, going back to the late 90s and early 2000s, we were writing up deals for value added and how to gain monetary value for the manure. We set the stage back then. We haven't really gained a lot of ground since then, in value-wise, but in education, the customer is buying into that value. Yes, absolutely, yes.
So... looking forward, you told me you had some ideas and some things to look forward to talk about.
Well, I think the big thing in my mind, especially after coming through a wet year like we had this past year, was that we need to be able to apply the nutrients when the crop needs it the most. That, in my mind, is ultra-critical to us going forward.
How are we going to do that?
Well, I think we need to adopt equipment that will allow us to go in crop to apply manure into standing crop. We've done it before. We need to grow that window of opportunity to spread manure in standing crop.
Looking back when hog industry was booming, and we had more hogs and more barns. And then, of course, there was a period where we had less barns and less hogs and, of course, less manure. Some people at that time, I think, noticed when they didn't have the manure, the value in that manure when they had it.
Oh, absolutely. And my brother-in-law, if I use him as an example, he said to me one day, he says, you know what, Doug, without manure, I would not be growing corn. He says, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, no manure, no corn. So you look at the U.S. Midwest, I visited with a number of existing and new producers, and I said, so why do you do this? Do you do it to build equity? Do you do it to create employment opportunity? Or why are you doing this? They laughed. They looked at me and said, this is a manure manufacturing plant first.
Exactly, right?
That's why they're doing it.
When you look at PED virus, biosecurity, I know I've talked to you about that before. Are you happy, or are you feeling that you're on track to make sure that you're doing the best job there too?
PED is a big concern of mine, and I think the biggest concern is our lack of education as to what to understand the disease and how it spread and what we need to reduce the incidence of it spreading. Some have said it's a lot like TGE. We don't need to worry quite as much, but I think there's things that we can be doing as far as separate accesses to farms. We need to keep the staff in the barn away from the lagoons. We need to figure out how we can apply the manure with less incidence of the risk of spreading, you know, the transporting of equipment from site to site. These are all concerns, but I think if we can better educate ourselves and better understand it, we can manage it better.
The hog industry, you've been in it?
Yep.
For a long time?
Yep.
And I've watched it maybe even longer. Where do you see it right now?
Oh, no, I'm getting more excited about the industry going forward. I see real opportunities. I watch the integrators identifying and cultivating new opportunities in new marketplaces, and I see that we need to restart the engine that we had going 12 years ago in order to help them satisfy their needs at the plant. Yes, I'm very excited about the industry going forward.
Well, that's a good piece of news from the hog side of the industry and manure management. Harry, your closing comments on that?
Just an observation. He talked about Iowa and how they are manure factories, referring to the hog barns. And I had a year ago, I talked to three farmers from that area, and that's exactly why they build barns. They don't even worry about how much they get for their pigs. They just want the manure so that they can put the manure down and save the money on the fertilizer and make sure their corn and soybeans are growing the best they can.
Hmm. All right. Well, Harry, I'm not sure if you're going to break away for lunch. We know you're big and hungry. Are you going to stay with us, or are you off to something else?
I think I'm going to be off to something else. Great show, Jack. I'm sorry I had to miss that one over there, and I also missed the one in Banff this year, but we're going to go to Switzerland in April, so we had to cut back somewhere.
Okay. Harry Siemens with us from Winkler here on the land. A great piece, and we thank you for that, Harry. Well, again, On the Land is coming to you today from Crop Week in Saskatoon. And yesterday's, closing speaker more or less ended the formal sessions of Crop Week, if you will, on the same note that we began. Listeners who were tuned into some of my agriculture reports earlier in the week would have heard from David Frum, David, a journalist, and his mother was the late Barbara Frum, a longtime broadcaster on the Mother Corporation CBC. David's job was to give us his ideas of what the Trump years might mean to trade in Canada, and he pretty much told us we don't know, it's an unknown. Yesterday, somewhat the same message from Mike Jubenville. Mike, of course, a well-known market analyst, and he was there to talk about world events and crop prices. Right now, Jubenville says he's neither bearish nor is he bullish. The markets are trading sideways. But interesting, he says, I guess people who know in sales often say purchases or sales are made more on emotion than they are on reason. And Mike was kind of talking about that in connection with the world markets. He says there's a rather weak sentiment abound right now.
There's always a demand for food that is insatiable, that is absolute, but the aggressiveness of that purchasing power is driven a lot of times by market sentiment. And if the sentiment is strong, commodity prices are strong. So this is just one thing I just try to keep aware of. It appears that the commodity index has bottomed, and there is still potential of U.S. dollar moving higher, which is maybe perhaps a bit worrisome from the broader perspective. But, you know, we kind of get that all tangled up with our relationship with the Canadian dollar. We always think that innately, low Canadian dollar, good for a canola price, or wheat price, or lentil price. Yes, but not entirely. Usually the Canadian dollar is weak because commodity markets are weak. The best canola prices we had, $12, $13, $14 a bushel, came when we were at par or better to the U.S. dollar. Conversely, some of the worst canola prices I remember, $6 a bushel, back in 1999, 2000 or so, was when we were at a 65-cent dollar. So if we're trading directly into the U.S., yes, selling down there, getting U.S. dollars coming back is a good thing. On a commodity like wheat, we trade the 70 countries of the world. And while our currency is down relative to the U.S. dollar, their currencies tend to be lower as well. So it's a matter, to me, of a reflection of demand for commodities rather than just an outright price thing. So when the U.S. dollar is strong and there's some concern about the global economy, commodities tend to suffer. But I think we're in the process of bottoming here. And again, you see this on crude oil. July of 2014, U.S. dollar going up, crude oil prices falling down. And I think we hit our lows, and I think we're sort of struggling around this $50 a barrel area on crude. So I think we are seeing the bottoming action slowly manifesting. And let's bring this to agricultural commodities. Again, July of 2014, soybeans goes down. And this is a graphic I see in corn, I see in wheat, I see in canola. As the U.S. dollar is going up, it's a signal, a canary in a coal mine of something in the broader economy that's amiss. Investment flow coming back to the U.S. We pay trade ship money, worries about offshore investments, bringing it back. And as the commodity sector sells off in that environment. But I use this as soybeans. Again, I could put up a number of different major ag commodities and show something similar. What I tend to find, and this is a perspective I have on the ag markets that goes back 2 years now, I was saying the same thing last year at this time as I am right now. That when I look at these ag markets from a historical perspective, soybeans is a monthly chart going back to 1988 or so, that whenever we see this environment of a spike up, a spike down, we never go straight back up again, unless there's a major production disaster occur. We go into a sideways trend for a period of time. Short supply rallies the markets, world overproduces, sells back down.
That again, Mike Jubinville speaking to Crop Week about the effects of the Trump administration, the U.S. dollar vis-a-vis the Canadian dollar. As we mentioned earlier, David Frum speaking earlier in the week regarding the unpredictability of Donald Trump, the bottom line of David Frum and Mike Jubinville agree is that we just don't really know. But there has been a lot of indication that there could be some disharmony between China and the USA, and that could be a tough situation for our markets, particularly crops like canola.
You add China into the mix, and it's been a rapid rise. That's how powerful they are in terms of their influence on the marketplace. And like I say, we get into a situation of trade frictions between China and the United States. We don't know for sure on how that will settle out, but obviously it would have a dramatic impact on Chicago soybean futures, but conversely, could it open the door for potential for increased production and export flow of Canadian soybeans, as soybeans are grabbing more and more acreage here in Western Canada. And also a possibility on the canola side. But again, that's a black swan issue. We just don't know.
That again, Mike Jubinville speaking during Crop Week in Saskatoon, looking at world markets. Well, a number of the commodity groups at Crop Week this year have passed a resolution asking the provincial government to hold up on its Bill 44, which is its water management bill. The groups that don't normally get much discussion into water policy, except it's always needed for crops, of course. But the canola growers, the oat growers, the sask wheat, and one other commodity group all passed the motion this week. Now, Frank Runaway is with the Saskatchewan Farm Stewardship Association, and he's a member of a number of these commodity groups. Frank was there to put forward the motion. We had this discussion following one of those sessions.
Can we summarize what the problem is with Bill 44?
The problem with Bill 44 is that it basically immediately take any type of drainage that's been done in this province, except for the CNDs, and puts it as illegal drainage or unpermitted drainage. The legislation is looking at bringing all this into compliance, and basically we, and that's fine. We just think that there's no way it can happen with the type of approval waiting time that we've seen on projects that are in the works right now. It also brings up so Bill 44 increases the fines from $10,000 a day to $1 million a day, and it get rid of the appeal board, which is a tool for the complaint process. It's basically there won't be an appeal board. So these are all things that we're concerned about as SAS Farm Stewardship Association and as farmers, it's too punitive, and with an agency that like the Water Security Agency, their track record hasn't been all that great into what they're doing. And so we want to see farmers able to manage their land, to manage their water in a way that it doesn't flood their neighbors. It protects the environment. It creates good wildlife habitat. And guess what? All this works hand in hand with having good crops and producing the best crops we can, reducing liability on crop insurance and all these good things. So we feel that we need to get back to a clean sheet and redraw a water policy that's actually enabling producers to do the best that they can do, which is grow crops, which is the solution for less water runoff. And that might sound contradictive, that actually drainage is a solution for less runoff. And I'm not sure if we get time here, but like, indulge me into a very simplistic way to look at the usage of water by crops. We used to get about 16 inches of rain in the 2000s or so, and a good crop will use about 16 inches of rain. So in the spring, we would run off about 2 inches of moisture in the form of runoff snow and whatever. And generally in August, we'd run short and kind of wish that we'd have, you know, a little more to get a good crop. Well, now we're getting about 24 inches. So if a good crop takes 16 inches, guess what? 8 inches have to run off. The problem is, and so people say, well, then we need to retain that moisture. But by the time you retain that moisture, you're starting to flood more land that stops the production of crops. So now what you on that land that's flooded, you're not shedding 8 inches, you're shedding 24 inches, all of the moisture that's coming off. So we can put dams and retain water all we want. By the time that is full, it runs off again over top. And what it does, the worst thing it does, that is farmers, I'm sure, can see on their land for themselves that the trees that are the vegetation that's surrounding all these sloughs the trees are dead. They're falling into the water. So the water is at very poor quality right now. And that's the water we're spilling into the environment. So the policy of retaining moisture is hurting us in public perception. And actually using the water in growing crops for the benefit of our farm, but also for the benefit of the economy. It's not well known that every dollar produced on every farm spins off into $4 into our economy. And I still would like to see what kind of spin-off we get out of sloughs that are full of dirty water and that are impeding our production.
Frank Grunewig, proposing a motion during crop week to a number of the commodity groups asking the provincial government to hold back on Bill 44, its new water management strategy. Well, the minister in charge, Scott Moe, says he's heard from some groups, he's talking, and he's going to do more consultation on the issue.
I'm going to very quickly reach out to each of those groups again in the very near future to maybe just further explain precisely what our goals are with the regulations that we introduced and how we're supporting those with this existing bill, just to ensure that there's no misinterpretation of what the efforts of the government of Saskatchewan are when it comes to controlling and organizing our water as we move it through the province of Saskatchewan. Just to back up a little bit, the regulations that this bill supports are based on a couple of very simple things. You know, the first is if you do want to move water off your property in the province, you need permission. You need permission from your neighbor or where that water is to go. And secondly, you need to have an outlet that can handle that water when it gets there. The permitting process, there may be a discussion or a requirement in that process to be able to control or manage when and where when that water flows and how much of that water flows, and that'd be done obviously through a gating system, and that would start at the farm gate. And what these regulations, the goal of these regulations is to ensure that people have the tools at the local level through formation of conservation and development authorities, formation of watershed associations, to form those groups that have the tools to be the master of their own destiny, if they will, to come up with some local and positive drainage opportunities across the province, and to have those permitted. What this bill does now is it supports those regulations in replacing this complaints-based system that we've had since 1986 in the province of Saskatchewan, of where drainage isn't addressed until there's a complaint, and quite often it's too late, and then it goes into a long and rigorous investigation system.
That again, Environment Minister Scott Moe reacting to motions passed during crop week regarding holding up Bill 44, which is the provincial government's water management strategy at present. Well, it's been a great week here at crop week, and we still have more to take in before the show closes at the end of the day, and many other great stories. Just for example, one of the stories we'll be following down the road, presentation on faba beans yesterday, a couple of presentations as farmers continue to look for crop diversifications. Faba beans could play an interesting role. There's a group in the Melford area which may be having some meetings right into our backyard in the Yorkton area regarding that, so we can look forward to that in upcoming programs. Also, just a note, the Jim Pattison group says the newly formed Pattison Agriculture Limited is now operating in 17 locations in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. Darren Didichuk of Swift Current says the new organization is called Pattison Agriculture, established from the consolidation of JD AgTech and Maple Farm Equipment. Of course, the new John Deere Maple Farm Equipment outlet in Yorkton, I think, is now occupied and operating. Well, thanks for joining us on the program today. Thanks to our producers, Scott Fitzsimmons and Harry Siemens, chirping in from southern Manitoba. I'm Jack Dawes, on the land from The Rock.
Thanks for listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you or your organization would like to appear on the program, call Jordan at 306-786-7625. All You Ever Wanted to Know, only on The Rock 98.5.